This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we learn about the details of the current threats from nuclear war as the hands of the doomsday clock are expected to advance closer to midnight this week.
Our guest, Paul Jay, is an award-winning journalist, filmmaker, and he describes the little-known histories of the Cold War that have led us up to where we are today.
We then speak with author Chip Gibbons about National Security Presidential Memorandum No. 7. Chip is the policy director of Defending Rights and Dissent.
We'll discuss with Chip the president's memorandum, supplemented by Pam Bondi's memorandum, clearly threatened to crush the left.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. In 1947, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists created a doomsday clock. It was meant to draw attention to the existential dangers posed by human technology. They set the metaphorical time to 7 minutes to midnight, with midnight symbolizing destruction of life on Earth. Just 2 years before, in 1945, the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The world saw firsthand the potential of nuclear annihilation. As World War II was ending, a different kind of conflict was underway, the Cold War. And over the next four decades, the United States and Soviet Union competed for nuclear dominance, not only through foreign policy and military strategy, but also on their respective home fronts, using propaganda and retaliation against critics. Throughout this period, people of conscience, like Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers in the early 1970s, repeatedly sounded the alarm. Ellsberg and others warned that there was no way to win a nuclear war. If one side launched, the other would inevitably respond, leading to mutual destruction. Today, more than 30 years after the end of the Cold War, the nuclear arms race continues. According to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, the United States and eight other nations continue to stockpile nuclear weapons, including Russia, China, Israel, Iran, Pakistan, France, the United Kingdom, and North Korea. Last January, a week after Donald Trump began his second term as president, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the doomsday clock forward to 89 seconds to midnight, the closest humanity has ever come to global catastrophe. The bulletin announced its decision to update the clock yet again this week. Whether the bulletin sets the clock closer to midnight or not, the question remains, is there the will to change our trajectory and a path to avoid global destruction? To help us explore these questions, our guest this segment is Paul Jay, award-winning journalist, filmmaker, and founder of TheAnalysis.News. Jay has spent decades investigating the inner workings of government, corporate power, and military policy, combining investigative rigor with a storyteller's clarity. He is currently working on a new documentary to be released in the fall of 2027. It's called How to Stop a Nuclear War, and it's based on extensive interviews with Daniel Ellsberg and narrated by Emma Thompson. The film examines how close humanity has come to nuclear catastrophe and why Ellsberg's warnings remain urgently relevant today. Paul Jay, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with current events. Since listeners may not be familiar with Donald Trump's nuclear policy, please tell us, in broad strokes, what is the administration's approach to nuclear weapons, both offensively and defensively?
Basically, a continuation of American nuclear protocol, doctrine, and investment, except more. Trump is not qualitatively different, but he's increasing the investment in nuclear weapons, as he is across the board in the military-industrial complex. But in nuclear weapons, the plan now in this new $1.5 trillion military budget will essentially increase nuclear investment by about 25%, which is, you know, very significant. The bigger departure, you could say, of Trump is he's returning to this idea of an anti-ballistic missile system, the so-called Golden Dome, which I call the Golden Khan, and my tagline is, it's not about the dome, it's about the gold. It's the latest in a series of massive, very dangerous boondoggles. Anti-ballistic missile systems more or less began in the mid-1950s. It started with not missiles. It was a system called SAGE to take down Soviet bombers. It's incredible how little people know about SAGE. And it's an important piece of our film because it really sets the pattern for Reagan's Star Wars, other forms of anti-ballistic missile systems under Nixon, under Bush II. But the significant expansion of the Golden Dome is a boondoggle on not on steroids. I'm not sure what the drug or the word to use would be. It's probably a $1 to $2 trillion investment. It's quite unlikely to work at all. And the only thing worse than it not working at all and being a complete boondoggle is if it does work. Because if it works at all, it's extremely destabilizing. It scares the hell out of Russia and China. And it means an even increased arms race to keep up with their fear of an anti-ballistic missile system. Now, why are they fearing an anti-ballistic missile system? Because everyone knows that has followed the story, ABM systems are essentially not defensive because everyone knows they can't stop everything, probably can't stop hardly anything. But if they can stop anything, they might be able to weaken a second retaliatory strike. In other words, an ABM system that kind of works enables an American first strike. And there's a long history within the Joint Chiefs of Staff and nuclear planning that a first strike is very much in the arsenal of American protocol, which is why they won't take first strike off the table, even rhetorically.
Paul, let's get into the substance of your film, How to Stop a Nuclear War. What kind of research did you do, and what inspired you to focus on Daniel Ellsberg as your subject?
Well, I think, and Dan thought, that the underlying reason why something isn't being done to prevent nuclear war is Cold War psychology. And I think it's very important that we understand the Cold War did not end. And I'll explain that in a second. But Dan's basic idea was, and it's not just his, the risk of accidental miscalculation, nuclear war, is not zero. And there's not anybody, it doesn't matter how much they want to defend the current American or global military structures, nuclear structures, nobody can say the risk is zero. And in fact, anyone that understands really this issue at all knows the risk is far from zero. So if the risk of an apocalypse, the risk of annihilation, nuclear winter, probably the end of humanity, if the risk is far from zero of accidental war, miscalculation, especially now with the introduction of artificial intelligence into command and control, maybe AI isn't going to say fire, but AI is the one that's going to interpret the sensor data, the ground-based radar systems, the massive amounts of data coming in to decide, is this launch for real? Is what's coming at us ballistic missiles? Or is what we're seeing geese or something bouncing off the moon, something which we've seen in the past? So the risk is, as I say, far from zero. So how come we're doing literally next to nothing to reduce that risk? The big powers, nuclear powers, aren't negotiating how to reduce risk. In fact, they're not even talking to each other about the risk of nuclear war. They're not. There's zero negotiations going on arms, new arms limitation treaties. So the question is why? Why aren't they reducing the risk? And two, why isn't the public outraged at this? And this is why we think, and when I say we, I'm including Dan, the Cold War psychology that they're out to get us, and the only thing that stops them, and them can change, you know, it can be the Soviet Union one day, it can be international terrorism the next day, and now it's China with a dose of Russia. There's always an external enemy that's exaggerated. The threat is exaggerated. And that's the essence of the Cold War. The Cold War was never about Soviet military expansionism because there wasn't any. You know, with the exception of being sucked into Afghanistan, and of course there were interventions in the Eastern European countries that were part of the Soviet Union, but as far as external military expansion beyond that, the CIA was telling the Truman administration, and from then on, the Soviet Union is in a defensive posture. Whatever you make what's going on domestically, and certainly Dan believed the Soviet Union was a tyranny, the political repression was severe domestically, but it was not an external military threat. Number two, let's be reminded of the fact that the U.S. policy all through the Cold War up until now has no problem with political repression in other countries. It just has to be a country that's not pro-American. In fact, between 1945 and 1990, it seems like as many as 200 dictatorships were created in the name of the Cold War. Basically, either through electoral manipulation, as in Italy in 1948, or funding the Greek fascists in 1948-49, right on to the Korean War, which is something we're researching in depth. And there's a reason they talk about the Korean War being the forgotten war, because it's in fact the template for everything that came afterwards. You prop up a vicious dictator, and you use the language of freedom and democracy to do it. And that becomes the template, whether it's Vietnam or all the other Cold War interventions, which I'm sure your audience is well aware of, whether it's in the name of fighting terrorism and so on. It's always wrapped in this kind of language, but it's always direct intervention to assert what was called in the 1942 by Luce the American century. The American century essentially was control the non-Soviet world. And then it became control the non-Soviet Chinese world. Obviously never about freedom or democracy. So what has that got to do with nuclear weapons? It's this underlying theory of deterrence. We need more. And if we need more, we know they're going to want more. So then we want more. So who benefits from this insanity? Obviously the people making the money out of building this stuff. And the investment and the justification for the nuclear threat and supposed deterrence is the backbone of the psychology of the whole military-industrial complex. It's not just about nukes. Everybody knows you can't deliberately use nukes against a nuclear power. And so far, there seems to be enough of a taboo of even using them against a non-nuclear power, either with fear that it might spill out into confrontation with a nuclear power, like they didn't use. Nixon certainly thought about and made some plans to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. Truman openly threatened them in Korea, but they didn't use them. And the same thing with the Russians in Afghanistan when they were, you know, losing in Afghanistan. They didn't use nukes. But that doesn't mean they won't. But the underlying thesis of the film, which again comes from Dan's stuff, is nobody in power wants to commit suicide. So the likelihood of a deliberate planned nuclear war, especially nuclear power against nuclear power is very, very remote. Again, not zero, but very remote. The problem is, as we know from history, it happens. So you get something happens, like 1983, people may know that follow this, a guy named Petrov is at a Soviet radar station and sees what looks like an attack has started. And it's at a time of the height of the Cold War. One of the facts we found, the Americans, just before this Petrov incident in 83, in the year or two, 1982, 1983, they were deliberately sending planes into Soviet airspace, feeling out the radar and making it look like a preparation for first strike. They wanted the Soviets on edge. So when this false radar reading comes in and this guy Petrov sees it, it's in the context of the Andropov, who was president of the Soviet Union. It's in the context of that where he already thinks a real preparation is coming. And in fact, Reagan is caught off mic, thinking he's off mic, and jokes to someone sitting next to him at a press conference or something, you know, maybe now is the time for a first strike. So it's right at moments of potential conflict that you get an accident that gets misinterpreted. You could see that now. Just imagine if the tensions over Taiwan go back to where they were when Pelosi visited, and there's Chinese are kind of blockading Taiwan. Guam is the forward base for an attack on China, as well as the Humphrey base in North Korea, which in fact most people don't know is the actual, by far the largest American military base in the world is in North Korea. And it's there not just to threaten the North Koreans, which is also dangerous in terms of nuclear war, but it's there as a forward base against China. Imagine if in a scenario of high, high tension, some space garbage takes out one or two American nuclear strategic satellites. And AI interprets that as the beginning of a first strike, because if there was a first strike coming from Russia or China, one of the first things they would do is knock out satellites. So the film is about what can we do to reduce this risk. And to answer that question, we're going to dig into Cold War psychology and how it still operates today, and what people can demand today to reduce the risk.
If you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm attorney Maria Hall, here with my co-host, attorney Michael Smith. We're speaking with award-winning journalist and filmmaker Paul Jay. Paul, for listeners who feel overwhelmed or powerless hearing all of this, what can individuals do to lower the risk of nuclear war?
Well, in some ways, it's somewhat like a climate change issue, which the difference is this. To really deal with the climate crisis, there needs to be a fairly fundamental change in the American and global economy. And we need to do it, because I'm not in any way underestimating how dangerous the climate crisis is. But to reduce the risk of nuclear war does not require a transformation of the global economy or the American economy. It can be done by implementing a few quite concrete proposals. Dan has proposed and others, but in general, nobody talks about them. So number one, educate yourself. Know these issues and start overcoming the taboo against them. The risk can be mitigated. See, there's an all or nothing psychology that's been created. You know, either nuclear war is coming and we're all dead, so what's the difference? Or we've been okay for 80 years, so why are we worried now? Like, both of these things are misconceptions, and dangerous misconceptions. The companies that make money out of this don't want us talking about it. The people in Congress, there's a handful that have tried to talk about this, and they have committees that try to do things. Mainstream media doesn't even cover it. So number one, educate yourself, and I hope our film will go a long way to doing that. Just to be clear, the film's coming out in September 2027, it's sort of the beginning of the next presidential cycle. So number one, get to know the issues. Number two, there's some concrete demands which people should confront both in the streets, and Dan always hoped that mass protest, whether it's about climate or whether it's no kings or whether it's about ICE, The issue of nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear war should be part of every mass protest. It is an imminent existential threat. We're not talking far off. The kind of scenario I'm talking about could happen tomorrow. We can't be in denial or go to sleep. Some other concrete steps, and maybe the most important, say absolutely no to the Golden Dome. The fraud of the Golden Dome is that every expert has said hitting an ICBM with an anti-ballistic missile is like hitting a bullet with a bullet, which is why Reagan's SDI thing never made any sense. Number two, even if now it's SDI plus AI, which is what the Golden Dome is, a big network of satellites and ground-based stations, but in the final analysis, you still have to hit a bullet with a bullet. Well, let's say AI can do that. Let's say. There's no proof. There's no evidence yet. But let's say. Let's give, you know, their artificial general intelligence can hit a bullet with a bullet. It is almost impossible that AI is going to be able to differentiate a bullet from the bullshit. No missile comes in by itself. It comes in surrounded by hundreds or even thousands of decoys. Decoys are cheap. You can spend your $2, $3 trillion on an anti-ballistic missile system. Nothing you're going to be able to do will overcome the relatively cheap technology of evading it. And everybody knows that's true, which is why it's not about the dome. It's about the gold. It's about the money that's going to be made. But like I said before, if it works at all, it's destabilizing. It makes Russia and China think a first strike is coming. So say no to the Golden Dome. Stop all funding and get educated to explain to people what I just said. And what I just said is really quite indisputable. And, you know, I don't think any expert would say I'm wrong, which is why even in the military leadership, there are people that have spoken out saying this whole thing's nuts. Be able to explain this. Even if people are thinking they're going to vote for Trump, the underlying thing, which I think is true, nobody actually wants a nuclear war. Nobody. I don't think Trump wants a nuclear war. Nobody wants a deliberate nuclear war. So the question is, why are they risking one? And I think people of every political spectrum, except a tiny handful that are, you know, maybe hoping for an apocalypse. But if that's a very, very tiny, slim fraction of people. So no Golden Dome. Number two, intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs, of which the United States has many, are inherently dangerous because it's use them or lose them. Now, if you saw this recent movie, House of Dynamite, it completely got this point wrong. No missile hitting Chicago creates a use them or lose them scenario because that's not where the ICBMs are. But it did get right the concept. ICBMs are the first things that will be targeted because, you know, Russia, China knows where they are, and they are the things that can do lots of destruction. So they're kind of tinderboxes. They're either useless because they're going to get hit, or something misinterpreted as an attack launches them, creates a use them or lose them, and the president says, you got to use them now, you're going to lose them, like that scene in the movie, and he decides to use them. The thing is, there's only one way to know for sure whether an incoming nuclear attack is actually a nuclear attack or birds or a moon or some AI hallucination. There's only one way to know. Let it come. Let it hit. And why? Because you can't stop it anyway. There is nothing achieved by a preemptive strike, even if you think something's on its way in, because you can't stop something if it's on its way in. It's way better to let it hit. Take the hit. Because why? Because U.S. has submarines that can always destroy the world. You know, the 14 nuclear submarines, each one of them can take out about 27 cities, one sub. The sub fleet can take out all of Russia, every major city in Russia and China, just the submarines. So if you're actually worried about deterrence, there's your deterrence. And you definitely don't need that many subs to have deterrence either. You could have, if Russia, U.S., and China really only cared about deterrence, and I have to say this is mostly being driven by the United States. You know, one or two subs, you know, isn't 30, 40 cities enough deterrence? You don't need all the rest of it. So demand an end to ICBMs. Get rid of them. Get rid of launch on warning. Get rid of ICBMs. All they are is another boondoggle. You know, there's an ICBM caucus in Congress from the states that have it. And the argument they give to defend ICBMs is not national security. It's all economic. Oh, it's jobs. You know, every time there's profit at stake, it's always about the jobs. Where, of course, if you took that money and invested it in, you know, productive infrastructure, you'd have more jobs. So those are two demands. Of course, sole authority, that one guy or woman can end the world. It's insane. And there's other issues we'll explore in the film. But I would say those two are the most decisive. The only other thing that's very pressing right now, no new testing. Russia and U.S. and China, because of it, although them too, they're all talking about beginning nuclear tests again. And nothing would spur a whole new arms race even more than it's already been spurred. So three things. No Golden Dome, no ICBMs, no new testing. Finally, at least talk to each other. At least have some kind of form of talking, like with North Korea, real easy. Agree to negotiate without preconditions. The Korean story I can't get into now, maybe another show, but the nuclear powers don't even have channels of communication open. So there's concrete demands people need to educate themselves about. And in the midterm elections, presidential elections, state elections, even at the city level, make this part of the conversation and break the taboo about discussing and debating nuclear war policy.
This has been a really important, if that's the right word, conversation. We're grateful to you. Can you tell us where listeners can learn more about your work and when and where they can see your film? It's called How to Stop a Nuclear War.
Well, like I say, the film's not coming out until the fall of 2027. We are now building a website. And when the website's fully built, when the film comes out, we are going to put all our interviews up in full, not just the parts that make the film. We're going to have a version of the film available on the website with QR codes. Every time we say something in the film, you can go to the QR code. It will take you to the whole depth of research of why we're saying what we're saying. But right now, the website is stop-nuclear-war.org. And we're beginning to put stuff up. There's a link there to get on our mailing list so you know when the film's coming out. But most importantly, when we start getting closer, and even now, if you want to get your name on the email list, we need a big campaign to get the film out, to get it seen. Who knows what the political climate in the United States is going to be in the fall of 27. I'm expecting there'll be even more large-scale protests. I'm expecting even more draconian crackdowns. Obviously, what's going on in Minneapolis is a rehearsal for martial law. Assuming there are midterms, and that's an assumption. I wouldn't bet money on it, but let's assume there are midterms. It looks like Trump is going to either lose the House and maybe the whole of Congress, but that means he'll just rule through executive order. Anyway, it is going to be a political shit show. But one of the things this film is going to do, and I'm extremely lucky because our funding is all philanthropic, and we have a decent funding to make the film, but our funding is not gatekeeper funding. You know, it's not a Netflix, it's not a major broadcaster. I hope we get on them at some point. But right now we're going to open theatrically, one way or the other, and we're going to question the entire assumptions of the Cold War. We are going to tell the real history, and we are going to tell the real story, the truth of the current state of and risk of nuclear weapons and the military-industrial complex. And it's going to be stuff that the mainstream media, and not just Republicans, but the leadership of the Democratic Party isn't going to much like either. So we're going to need a lot of help getting this film out. And we are really appealing across the political spectrum. This isn't a film just for people that are support progressive politics. It's very important. In fact, we're going to test the film in areas that vote for Trump and the Republicans. And we're not going to mitigate what we say. But I think nuclear war really does transcend normal political boundaries, which in some ways makes the film even more dangerous.
Give our listeners that website one more time, please.
stop-nuclear-war.org.
Paul Jay, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks much for the invitation.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The forces of American fascism are rapidly consolidating in our country. It is chilling to think that President Trump has only been in office for 1 year. American fascism is a unity of the MAGA forces around Trump and certain billionaire sectors of the American capitalist class. Their project, like those of the Nazis in Germany, is what the Germans called Gleichschaltung, meaning bringing it into line. In America, independent centers of power have been brought into line. Universities, the large law firms, the media, and much of the court system. The Supreme Court is now subservient to the dictates of the Trump administration. President Trump is working to get more people and institutions to knuckle under. We talk today about his threat to crush the left with the recent issuance of his National Security Presidential Memorandum Number 7. It is known as NSPM7. The genius of the U.S. Constitution, which limited power by setting up a system of checks and balances, has all but been destroyed. Trump is ruling by executive orders. The Supreme Court uses the shadow docket to avoid public consideration of cases involving liberty. Congress is not consulted about declaring war. Trump secretly bombed Venezuela and kidnapped his leader and his wife. The voting rights bill has been gutted. It's not illegal for big corporations to contribute any amount of money they want to elections. Both the Democratic and Republican parties are subservient to big capital. The old form of democracy, however limited by race and class, has almost been disappeared. ICE is being used to terrorize the population in major American cities. Already its budget is $11 billion a year. They are seeking to hire another 10,000 recruits, recruited at places like gun shows and given a $50,000 signing bonus and salaries ranging from $49,000 a year to $89,000 a year. NSPM7 targets those who speak out against racism, war, injustice, misogyny, capitalism, and white Christian nationalism. Our guest, Chip Gibbons, has written about NSPM7. Mr. Gibbons is the policy director of Defending Rights and Dissent. His organization has boosted awareness of the perils of this memorandum. Mr. Gibbons edits the Gaza First Amendment Alert. He's the author of the forthcoming book, The Imperial Bureau, the FBI, Political Surveillance, and the Rise of the U.S. National Security State. Chip Gibbons, a welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I've been a longtime fan of the program and all of the work you've done and the good guests you've had on.
Thanks, Chip. Sometimes decades go by without much happening. And other times, decades happen within a few weeks. We're in such a time now. I would like to speak with you, Chip, about President Trump's National Security Memorandum Number 7, which was signed on September 29 of last year. It was then supplemented by a second memorandum by Attorney General Pam Bondi on the implementation of the President's memo. Let's talk about the President's memo first. What is it?
Well, you know, this is the second event in several months I've done where someone has invoked the quote about there are weeks where decades happen and decades where weeks happen. We are certainly living in a time where decades happen in weeks. And Trump's National Security Presidential Memorandum Number 7 is no exception. It is what I called in drop site news, essentially a blueprint to crush the U.S. left, to crush Trump's opposition. And it takes, as it will, if you may, as its sort of Reichstag moment, the killing of Charlie Kirk. Kirk was a right-wing internet figure who was very close to the administration. Obviously, whatever one thinks of his views, I find them terrible. Killing someone is, you know, not good, not great. But it builds off of that, this sort of narrative that the left is somehow responsible for violence or trying to kill people. And it does that through these very tenuous connections between political dissent and violence. And this is an old theme in American history. You know, slave owners said that abolitionists, by saying abolish slavery, were causing slave uprisings, which hopefully they were, but, you know, it's the speech violence connection. You know, people have said that by criticizing the police, you incite violence against the police, et cetera. And it sort of builds on that narrative that's been part of sort of political policing for 200 years. And, you know, they're very clear about what their attempts are. Stephen Miller, who is behind a lot of this, has said their goal is not to mimic the ACLU of the mid-1990s, as in defending free speech. And, you know, they made supposed left-wing attacks on free speech a huge part of their campaign, but to take all rational steps to save civilization. So you have this very fascistic language about being in a civilization war. And this has produced National Security Presidential Memorandum Number 7, which came on the heels of an earlier executive order designating Antifa as a domestic terrorism organization. There is no statutory definition or power for Trump to do that. But he did. And, you know, when we got that memo, the executive order on Antifa, the big question was how serious is this or how much bluster it is. And I think National Security Presidential Memorandum 7 makes clear that this is serious. A lot of people in the Trump administration are evil, but they're also deeply incompetent. It's what happens when you have government by podcasters sometimes. But this memo was written by somebody who has deep, deep familiarity with the U.S. national security state and with how it can be used to smash the left. It brings in a bunch of other agencies. It tasked the Secretary of Treasury to apply powers traditionally used against money laundering and international terrorism to ferret out the funders of so-called domestic terrorism. It instructs the IRS to make sure tax-exempt entities are not directly or indirectly financing political violence, domestic terrorism. And it instructs the Attorney General to come up with a list of recurrent motives and indicators of groups that engage in supposed domestic terrorism activity so they can prevent potential violent activity before it happens. And prevention is a really troubling concept and something to look out for here. Obviously, in a democratic society, the idea of preventative policing, targeting people before they've committed crimes, runs afoul of being a democratic site, right? So it's like a pre-crime type thing. But in the terrorism context, where it's most frequently used, and prevention is the official counterterrorism policy post 9/11, and we can talk about its origins, which go way before 9/11 and go back to reactions to the Church Committee, to Watergate. You know, you're trying to find terrorists before they strike. And what makes someone a terrorist and not just a violent criminal? It's the political motivation. So the way prevention works is you look for people who are likely to commit the crime. And when it works in terrorism, you go out and look for people who are likely, who have those views that you say are the terrorist views. And you have a list of views in these memos, anti-Christian, extreme views on race, things like that. What you're telling people to do is to look for people with those views. And the FBI guidelines, and the bulk of this is implemented by the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, I believe we're going to discuss in more detail later, you know, they have very loose guidelines. There were restrictions put on them after Watergate, after the Church Committee, after the revelations about the spying on King, the spying on the anti-Vietnam War movement. And the FBI can actually open a type of investigation now called an assessment on someone or an organization where there's no factual predicate to believe they threaten U.S. national security or are likely to commit a crime as part of this sort of pre-crime framework. So it really is a use of the existing preventative policing counterterrorism structure to go after the administration's perceived domestic enemies on the left. And it does that without new laws. It does that just by using the FBI and all these counterterrorism structures as they actually currently exist.
After 9/11, the Patriot Act was passed. Liberties were lost. How does the current government repression stand on the shoulders of the Patriot Act?
The Patriot Act in of itself was this sort of omnibus wish list bill that expanded sort of a lot of types of electronic surveillance, the definition of material support, and other sort of pre-existing counterterrorism or foreign intelligence surveillance structures that existed in the U.S. It made it easier to get warrants from the secret FISA court. For people who don't know, the U.S. has basically a dual-track surveillance system. You have criminal surveillance, which is supposed to be about gathering evidence for a prosecution, a court of law. I doubt that's what any of us think the police really do, but let's just play along for a minute with that. And then you have foreign intelligence surveillance, which is traditionally much broader and is supposed to be about sort of gathering information that is needed in the realm of foreign intelligence. What the Patriot Act did was dramatically expand the scope of foreign intelligence surveillance, which has a lesser standard, and make it easier to bring it into a court. It was part of a wider sea change in U.S. National security policy. So the FBI, you know, after 9/11, they get new guidelines. The guidelines were the sort of bête noire of a lot of sort of old school McCarthyites and neo-McCarthyites. They were part of this narrative that because the FBI was so restricted after the Church Committee, they missed 9/11. That's totally, completely false. I obtained documents via FOIA and working on my book that show like what the FBI was doing in the months up to 9/11. They were doing extremely intrusive surveillance on anarchists. They have a document that the big threat is anarchists. This is August 2001, because anarchists have already killed President McKinley. 100 years later, the FBI is really getting to the point. And because of the big World Trade Organization protests. So the FBI had lots of powers. But John Ashcroft and Robert Mueller really used this moment to do what Hoover did in the 1930s and rebuild the FBI, not as a law enforcement agency, but as an intelligence agency. And I think a lot of people don't realize this. The FBI has two components. It's a law enforcement agency, you know, cops with federal badges. It's also a intelligence and national security agency that implements executive orders around national security and does all kinds of things sort of outside of law enforcement. And the FBI post 9/11 officially describes itself as an intelligence-driven national security agency with law enforcement and intelligence components. They say intelligence twice, so you know they're super smart at the FBI, right? But the big part of this was this idea that they were moving away from prosecuting terrorists after the fact based on evidence, what they say law enforcement does, and using intelligence to gather information to prevent and disrupt terrorists before they strike. And, you know, on a certain level, as horrific as that is, you might be able to understand how one would adopt that after a terror attack like 9/11, but it's worth pointing out that that was not a new idea. That as soon as the Church Committee report is issued, in the dissenting opinion, Barry Goldwater says, these restricting the FBI from spying on civil rights activists and anti-war activists and political speech will prevent us from preventing terrorism. And the Heritage Foundation enters the scene a few years later with all of these sorts of theories that the shutting down the investigation of the Socialist Workers Party of 26 years, they literally cite that as a bad thing, getting rid of police files on communists, getting rid of the House Un-American Activities Committee and restricting the FBI, all of the big McCarthyite right, big McCarthy packages, hinders our ability to prevent terrorism. And if we don't prevent terrorism, we'll end up like Rhodesia, an apartheid state. And they didn't mean we'd become an apartheid state. They meant that we would cease to be one, perhaps. I don't know. Invoking Rhodesia was very odd. And then in the 80s, you get this committee in the Senate, the Denton Committee, which is heavily influenced by a staffer from the Heritage Foundation, which pushes this notion very heavily. They pressure the FBI to change the guidelines. The FBI cites them for why they investigated Central American Solidarity activists. On this program, people will probably be interested to know that someone during that committee said people who provide legal support to terrorists are more dangerous than those who throw bombs. And my understanding from Marjorie Cohen is that the NLG made buttons that said more dangerous than those that throw bombs. That's where that came from. And again, they keep returning this idea that, yes, the FBI is restricted now to people who are going to commit crimes or are foreign agents, but what about people who aren't going to yet? We need to prevent that by surveilling subversive movements, because political movements produce terrorism, right? The Heritage Foundation in their report actually says, right, the anti-Vietnam War movement and the civil rights movement produce people who are terrorists, so you needed to be spying on those movements to know who the future terrorists were. Of course, those movements were heavily surveilled, heavily infiltrated, and lo and behold, no terrorism was prevented. And in these sorts of 80s committee hearings, you know, where they're attacking the National Lawyers Guild and the usual suspects, you hear them citing about, you know, movements that had produced threats, movements to support the Spanish Republicans, movements against the Vietnam War, and that current movements for a nuclear freeze for prisoner rights could similarly produce terrorists. So as soon as they start rolling back McCarthyism, the Generation One McCarthyites come up and say, oh, we just want to prevent terrorism. And they frame it initially in very McCarthyite terms. And then post 9/11, that becomes the official policy of the FBI and of John Ashcroft and the Department of Justice. They don't talk about the Socialist Workers Party or Red Squads gathering files on communists, but the underlying language used is what had been developed for the 26 years in the reaction to the restrictions on the intelligence community and the disbanding of HUAC and the defunding of the Subversive Activities Control Board, which then sort of post 9/11, they adopt that sort of framework, which is a terrible framework for preventing terrorism, but a great framework for spying on political dissent. And all throughout the Trump memo, you see references to prevention, to disruption, this language that is sort of the post 9/11 counterterrorism language.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall, and we're speaking with Chip Gibbons, who is from the Defending Rights and Dissent Organization, a fine organization. Chip, COINTELPRO was the infamous political police program to disrupt and destroy groups that challenged the status quo. Please talk about COINTELPRO. Is it dead in the water, or is it still amongst us? Is it still functioning?
So counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO, when people use that term, it's generally used one of two ways. One is by sort of the general public, which is to refer to the Hoover-era surveillance of political speech writ large. And in that sense, COINTELPRO is absolutely still among us. It never went anywhere. It's very much embodied in this memo. The other way, when people talk about COINTELPRO, which is the more technical way, is to refer to a specific set of programs beginning in 1956, targeting the Communist Party, later targeting the Socialist Workers Party, Puerto Rican independence movement, so-called black hate groups. They later changed to black extremist groups, even the Klan. And these were programs of covert action, and they were discrete programs, and they were discrete actions targeting people who were already victims of FBI surveillance under another program. So like COINTELPRO starts in 1956. The sort of modern Hoover-era surveillance starts in 1939, when they interpreted a presidential directive from Roosevelt to give them the power to first investigate people who they deem are subversive, and then to investigate people who might be influenced by subversives. So the infamous spying on Martin Luther King was opened as a communist infiltration investigation to see if members of the Communist Party might be influencing him. And that's how they justified the wiretaps. And the early COINTELPRO actions against the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were actually under the Communist Party counterintelligence program. As the Church Committee pointed out, this is totally nonsensical, right? Because the so-called targets of communist infiltration were often treated much harsher than communists themselves, and it was clear this was a pretext to surveil and destroy these people. So does COINTELPRO, as the official program of covert actions targeting people already being surveilled by the FBI, still exist? I mean, formally it does not, and it was so I would say no. And we've never really uncovered sort of the worst types of abuses, like the King suicide letter still continuing. But the larger program of political surveillance is absolutely still with us. And in many ways, it functions much in the same way. So, for example, Hoover said he could spy on groups that might be infiltrated by communists. We repeatedly see in FBI files, such as the files spying on the School of America's watch, which opposes American funding or training of death squads and dictators, that their movement is peaceful, but an unknown violent actor could infiltrate it, use it for their own ends, thus they must continuously surveil it. One of the most grotesque things that the Hoover FBI did was what was called racial intelligence. They actually set up a ghetto informant program where they got like 6,000 or 7,000 people to act as community listening posts in black communities and report back to the FBI. Today, in the name of preventing terrorism, the FBI says it needs to gather demographic information about where groups of people who produce terrorists live. And that can include where ethnic-oriented businesses are. I don't know what an ethnic-oriented business is, and I sure do not want to know what the FBI defines that as. I think that would be very troubling to hear. But, you know, under that mandate, they've said things like, well, we know a lot of Muslims are terrorists, let's track where all the Muslims are. Or in a domain awareness, as they call it, domain awareness, not racial intelligence now, they were concerned about the threat of black separatists, so they looked at growth of the black population in the area of Atlanta. This is in the 21st century, not the Hoover era. So, well, you know, COINTELPRO itself doesn't exist, and the really extreme parts of it don't exist. The program of surveillance that produced counterintelligence program is very much alive and well. Just the rationale has changed. And it's interesting because I know I'm going off on a tangent. I plead guilty to that. From like 1939 to about 1970-something, all of the FBI surveillance is predicated on a presidential directive from Roosevelt that Hoover said gave him the power to spy on subversives. In the 70s, people start to question that, and they briefly change the basis of the program to being they're gathering intelligence to prevent the violation of six statutes. And it looks very much like what Pam Bondi is doing in her implementation memo. It looks very much like this. And it very much sort of preconfigures, you know, what they're doing now. That you sort of take the Hoover program, you say, okay, we're not just aimlessly spying, we're doing preventative intelligence. Oh, by the way, there's no rational relationship to any of the things we're spying on and these statutes, and we're not finding any, you know, criminal evidence. There's actually a very hilarious exchange between, I think it was the Pike Committee, the House version of the Church Committee, the House equivalent of Church Committee, about the investigation into the Socialist Workers Party under the Smith Act. Why they still use the Smith Act as a grounds for investigation? Say, well, no one's been prosecuted under the Smith Act in, you know, 20-some years. And the FBI goes, yes, under current Supreme Court precedents, we couldn't prosecute someone under it, so we're not prosecuting anyone for it, but we're investigating people to prevent them from violating this unconstitutional law. And that's, you know, that's the FBI in a nutshell.
Chip Gibbons, why is the Trump administration doing all of this now?
Well, I think the Trump administration sort of represents the hard right id of U.S. national security policy. I think there's a through line between this sort of memo and, you know, early experiments in red squads at the local level, the Cold War McCarthyism, the sort of persecution of Muslims after 9/11, well, before 9/11 too, but escalated after 9/11. I think that the Trump administration very much is the embodiment of the sort of hard right id that has animated a lot of those policies. It certainly has escalated them dramatically. And Trump is a unique threat in that sense that there's just a dramatic escalation, but it's not a rupture from the past. And I think if there's anything we should take away, it's how decades, a century of U.S. national security, U.S. homeland security, U.S. internal security, to go back to a Hoover-era term, whatever you want to call it, has paved the way for a Trump-like figure.
Chip, we're coming to an end to our allotted time, unfortunately, but I wanted to ask you this. If they're really intent on crushing the left, what do you think we should do about it? What is your organization doing about it?
Well, our organization is Defending Rights and Dissent. We're a national civil liberties organization that defends the American people's right to know and freedom to act through grassroots mobilization, public education, policy expertise, and advocacy journalism. So much of what we do is educating the public and decision makers just about what's going on. And I know that's not the final step, but it's certainly the first step, because you have people walking around who don't know this is happening. You have members of Congress who are on committees that are supposed to oversee the FBI, and they don't, you know how the FBI works. It's pretty scary. And, you know, we're up on the Hill. We're telling lawmakers, you know, what are the laws that are enablers? How do you change them? We're telling them what kinds of programs are taking place within the FBI and how to frame the question when the FBI comes to testify to actually get an answer. We do a lot of Freedom Information Act requests and publishing what we learn from them. FOIA, of course, is a very difficult process. The FBI is not very transparent, and oftentimes, even when we are lawfully entitled to information, the FBI just sort of throws up their hands and say, okay, sue us then. And we do, and we get it, but that's an annoying process, to be very blunt.
Can you tell us about how people can be in touch with Defending Rights and Dissent?
You can visit us online at rightsanddissent.org. That is D-I-S-S-E-N-T. You will be surprised by how many people think it's dissent, like going down the stairs, not dissent, like telling Donald Trump, absolutely not, we're going to invade Greenland. But that's a frequent mistake, so I have to tell people about it. If you visit us there, you can find out about all of our current work, including lawsuits we have going against the FBI. We're getting ready to launch a big FOIA lawsuit against DHS, FBI, state, ICE over the surveillance, targeting, and detaining of Palestinian students, pro-Palestinian students, and we are, you know, fighting NSPM7. We're educating the public about it. You can learn all about that at rightsanddissent.org.
Thank you so much, and come back on when your new book is out. Thank you again.
Yes, please have me when the book is out. It's going to be out later this year.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
You're listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh. WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. My name is Steve, your host for the Deep Blues Hour, and I'll be bringing you 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues. And in this hour, we're going to hear a whole bunch of good piano blues from artists such as Memphis Slim and Robert McCoy, maybe some Roosevelt Sykes and Alex Moore in there as well. Big Joe, too. Lots of good piano blues. But don't forget, we're also going to hear from some fine pre-war artists like Tommy Johnson and Tommy McLennan. It's all coming up here on this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. And we'll start things off with Mr. James Cotton, along with Joe Louis Walker and Charlie Hayden. This is called Everybody's Fishing. James Cotton here on the Deep Blues Hour. WRCT, Pittsburgh.